So this will not be a regular statistical mechanics course in the sense that I will assume that you know sort of the basics of statistical mechanics and the you know, things like theory of ideal gases. Okay, so if you find yourself deficient in this area, then so your tutor is here, and you should ask her to refresh your memory. Okay. So what we will focus on is the theory of phases and phase transitions. So normally this is something that's taught in advanced statistical mechanics classes, but you know, since this is PSI, this is going to be your regular StatMech. Okay. So you know, so this is one of the sort of most fundamental facts in physics that matter organizes itself in different phases. Right? Organizes itself in phases, and the examples of that you know from just from your everyday experience. So almost any substance exists, for example, in a solid, liquid, or gas phase, depending on temperature and pressure, right? So that's the simplest example. Solid, liquid, and gas. You also know that certain metals can be either ferromagnetic, meaning they can have a macroscopic magnetic moment in the absence of any external magnetic field below certain temperature, and then above this temperature, it's going to be paramagnetic, so that a magnetic moment is going to disappear, right? So that's another example of a pair of phases. Ferromagnet, paramagnet. Another example that's also probably well known to you is that most metals, if you cool them down to very low temperatures, become superconducting. So they can conduct electricity with absolutely no resistance, while at high temperatures, they are regular metals. So there is a finite resistance. So that's another example of two distinct phases. So superconductor normal metal, and so on. So there are many other examples. And so, you know, our objective in this course will be to try to understand how macroscopic matter organizes itself in different phases and how transitions between the different phases happen. Okay. So a very fundamental idea in this whole field is that the appearance of phases is a consequence of ordering. Okay. So just one thing that I forgot to mention. What do we really mean by saying that matter exists in different phases? Right? What we mean is that there are certain macroscopic properties that exist in one phase, right, and don't exist in the other phase. So for example, if you take this triad, solid, liquid, and gas, so how do we really distinguish between solid, liquid, and gas? Right? So solid has a macroscopic property that's called rigidity to shear. So solid has rigidity to shear. Namely, you know, if I take a solid rod, right, and I try to twist it on one end, then that twist is going to be felt at the other end. Okay, so that's what we really mean by rigidity, while liquid does not have rigidity to shear. And that's how we distinguish between liquid and solid, the existence or not of this property of rigidity. So liquid null rigidity to shear. So rigidity is one example of such macroscopic property that distinguishes different phases. What about liquid and gas? So that's a little more subtle. You cannot always distinguish between liquid and gas. But when you can, what distinguishes them is interface, right? So if you put liquid in a container, right, you can distinguish the liquid from the air, let's say, outside the liquid by the fact that the liquid has a well-defined interface. While a gas, if you put gas in a room, then the gas will just fill all available volume, right? So there is no interface for a gas, okay? So liquid has a well-defined interface, while gas does not, okay? For the ferromagnet, paramagnet, as I already mentioned, so ferromagnet is distinguished from paramagnet by the fact that a ferromagnet has a macroscopic magnetization in the absence of the external field, while paramagnet does not have macroscopic magnetization, right? So ferromagnet has macroscopic macroscopic magnetization, while paramagnet does not, okay? And so now that that fundamental idea comes in, so the really important idea in this whole field is that the appearance of such macroscopic properties, which either exist or not, right, is a consequence of ordering, okay? So this, appearance of macroscopic properties that distinguish phases macroscopic, right? So macroscopic meaning that, you know, so rigidity is a property of the whole solid, right? Distinguishing phases is a consequence of ordering. So for example, the rigidity of a solid is a consequence of the fact that microscopically, right, the atoms in a solid arrange themselves in an ordered crystal lattice. Okay, so this is something that you will presumably hear more about in condensed matter physics course. But, so the rigidity is a consequence of ordering of atoms in a crystal lattice. The ferromagnetism of a ferromagnet is a consequence of the fact that microscopic magnetic moments of atoms align in a particular direction. Okay? So ferromagnetism is a of atomic magnetic moments and so on. Okay. And so what we will be talking about in this course is really the theory of ordering, okay, in different circumstances. So let me start by considering the simplest model that exhibits this phenomenon of ordering, okay? So this model is called the Ising model. So let me imagine that I have a lattice, okay, hypercubic lattice in d dimensions. So as we will see later, it will be convenient for us to keep dimensionality of space general, okay? In fact, so when we talk about renormalization group, we will assume that dimensionality of space is a continuous variable that can change continuously, okay? But for now, let's just assume that it's some general dimensionality d. So I have d dimensional cubic lattice. So for example, in when d is equal to 2, this will just be a square lattice. Which is the only thing I can draw comfortably. And I'll assume that on every side of this lattice, we have a degree of freedom. So I'll label the lattice sides by letters I and J, okay? And then I'll assume that on every side of this lattice, I have a degree of freedom, which I'll call sigma I, okay? Which can take only two values. It can be either equal to plus 1 or minus 1. So in a sense, you know, this is kind of the most elementary degree of freedom you can imagine. It can just take two values. You can think of this as a bit, as an elementary bit of information, okay? And then I'll assume that those degrees of freedom on different sides of the lattice can interact with each other, okay? And the Hamiltonian describing this interaction is going to look like that. So I'll have minus 1/2 sum over all, so double sum over the sides of this lattice, I and J. Then some parameter Jij, capital Jij, that's going to describe the strength of the interaction between sides I and J, right? And then a product of sigma I and sigma J, right? And 1/2 here just corrects for double counting of the pairs. Okay? So, you know, if... Yes, so I want minus sign for the following reason. So so what does this Hamiltonian want to do, right? It wants to align all the elementary degree of freedoms, all the elementary degrees of freedom on different sides, right? So if all sigma i's on different sides are equal to 1 or minus 1, because of this minus sign, the energy is minimized, right? If there was a plus sign, then I would want to anti-align different degrees of freedom, okay? That's also possible, but just for simplicity, I want to make this a minus sign, okay? Yeah.
Consider a finite lattice or
if the sign is minus here, whether it's bipartite or not, does not matter, right? Because all you want to do is just align them. But yeah, so what you know, if I consider a hypercubic lattice, it's a bipartite lattice, meaning that I can divide it into two sublattices. Okay, but that's not important for now.
When can you divide it into two sublattices?
Well, because I can just let's say I take those sides So this will make one sublattice, while these sides will make the other sublattice. And if the interaction here is only between nearest neighbor sites, then you see that spins, these degrees of freedom on one sublattice only interact with degrees of freedom on the other sublattice. So that's important if you I really want to anti-align those degrees of freedom. For this sign in front of the Hamiltonian, that's not important. Okay.
One question. When you say that you want them to align or anti-align, if I consider, for example, in a general dimension, my hypercubic lattice, I will still have 2 degrees of freedom for each lattice.
Yes.
Point?
So it's, yeah. So it's just plus or minus one. Yeah.
So in this case, what do you mean by aligning or anti-aligning?
Well, I just, so let's say I want all of them to be equal to plus one, or all of them to be equal to minus one. I don't want neighboring spins to be plus and minus one. Okay, okay, so what was I saying? So, you know, if you want kind of make this model more concrete, you can think of those degrees of freedom as real spins, let's say, that can point only up or down. Okay, so in that kind of case, this Hamiltonian actually describes ferromagnetic ordering of those spins. But you can also think of this in a more abstract way as just degrees of freedom that can take two values, plus or minus one. Okay? Okay, so this model has two distinct phases. Which I'm gonna call ferromagnetic and paramagnetic. Okay, so there are two phases. Ferromagnetic phase and paramagnetic phase. So the names refer to the situation when those degrees of freedom really describe spins on the lattice sides, right? But I will use those names in general, okay? So how do we distinguish those two phases? So they're distinguished by what's called order parameter. Which I will call magnetization M, and which is equal to average, so thermodynamic average of sigma I on any site, right? I'm going to assume that all the sites here are equivalent, right? And so that average is the same on all the sites. So then, if this M, if the average value of sigma I is not zero, right? So that's what I really mean by all the spins aligning on all sides, right? So this will be the ferromagnetic phase. While when M is equal to zero, this is the paramagnetic phase. Okay. And so if you were to, let's say, solve this model on a computer numerically, then what we would find is the following. So if you calculated this order parameter M as a function of temperature, as a function of T, right, then at zero temperature, so all we have to do is just minimize the energy, right? Just minimize this energy, and then it clearly it's minimized when all sigma i's are either equal to plus one or minus one, right? So let's say they're all equal to plus one. But then, so as we increase the temperature, thermal fluctuations will come in, right? Which will decrease the average value of M. in some way. And eventually, fluctuations become so strong that M vanishes. Okay? So that temperature where M vanishes is called the critical temperature, TC. And so the important, very important point is that M actually vanishes exactly at TC. It does not simply become very small. It exactly vanishes. So this means that M behaves non-analytically at this point, right? So this function is finite, M of T. The function M of T is finite for T less than TC, but then it's exactly zero for T greater than TC, okay? This is a quite a non-trivial point, and you know, in the early days of statistical mechanics, people did not actually believe that physical quantities can behave in this way. But they actually do, okay?
This is with zero, right?
Yeah. Okay, another very important observation we can make about this model is the following. So if you look at this Hamiltonian, you immediately notice that it's invariant under the following transformation. So H is invariant under the following transformation. If I just take all the sigma i's on all the sides of this lattice and I change their sign, right? If I change all sigma i's, to minus sigma i's, clearly H does not change because it involves products of sigma i's. Okay. So H does not change, right?
Because what does that physically imply? It has transversal mirror symmetry?
Well, it has a symmetry between whether the spins are, so if you think of these degrees of freedom as spins, right? Then the spins can either point up or down. That does not matter. Yeah.
So is this behavior at the critical temperature only non-analytic in the case of infinite lattice?
Yeah. Yeah. So we will talk about that. Yeah. Right. So the Hamiltonian is invariant under this transformation. However, when we say that order parameter is not zero, right, that means that we are picking a particular sign for that order parameter, right? Let's say here it's plus one and not minus one. So that means that the ferromagnetic phase breaks that symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian has symmetry with respect to reversing the sign of all spins, while the ferromagnetic phase itself breaks that symmetry. Okay? So the FM in the FM phase this symmetry is broken, okay? And it's broken spontaneously in the sense that, the system with equal probability can choose to polarize in the up direction or in the down direction, right? Those two events are equally probable, and the system spontaneously chooses what to do. in what direction to polarize. Okay? So that's called, therefore, spontaneously broken symmetry. So basically, the existence of a non-zero order parameter is tied in this way to spontaneously broken symmetry. Spontaneously broken symmetry. Okay.
This, even if the, in terms of the order parameter, even if you flip the situation entirely, the physics remains the same. If instead of one, I had a minus one. So not entirely sure where does like how the symmetry is broken, because if I just
You're right that you know. So if I start, let's say, from magnetization up, right? And then I somehow flip all the spins down, the energy will remain the same, and everything will remain the same. But the point is that if you have an infinite lattice, the probability of that event happening, all the spins suddenly flipping from up to down, is vanishingly zero. And so the system will actually exist in one of those either m equals plus 1 or m positive or m negative, it will exist in that state indefinitely. That's what I mean by broken symmetry. So the state of the system is less symmetric than what's implied by the Hamiltonian. Yeah?
How does the system choose whether to go into the spins up?
Well, right. So that's a question. So it chooses it spontaneously. So in reality, in a real ferromagnet, let's say, there will always be some small external influence, right, that prefers a particular situation, right? But so if you talk about theory, then it's a spontaneous choice, right? Well, we basically place the system in one of those states, and then it exists in that state forever. Okay? Okay, so let's actually discuss that important issue that, so in fact, as we'll see in just a second, such a spontaneously broken symmetry is only possible when the size of the system is infinite, okay? So let's see how that happens. Okay. Can I actually lift that blackboard? Okay. Oh, I see. Okay.
So this is the front part. Uh-huh. So
okay.
Raise
this thank you. Okay. So let me take that Ising model Hamiltonian and add what I will call a magnetic field to it, right? So it's going to be an actual magnetic field again if those degrees of freedom are identified with spins. But so in general, it will be just a field that couples linearly to the degree of freedom, right? So I'll have minus 1/2 sum over I and J, I, J, sigma I, sigma J, and then I will add the following term, minus B, sum over I, sigma I, right? So the point of this term is that, you know, it clearly prefers a particular sign of sigma I. So if B here is positive, then the energy here would be minimized if all the spins were pointing up, right? And let me assume for a moment that the system is actually finite, okay? So let me assume that my lattice has n capital sides, okay? And let me assume that I'm in the ferromagnetic phase, so M is not equal to zero, right? So then, if I'm in the ferromagnetic phase, the sum over all the spins in the lattice of sigma i's is going to be approximately equal to n times m. Because the fluctuations, when you sum over all the lattice, will roughly cancel out. Okay? So I'll have 1 over n sum over I sigma I is going to be, for a large lattice, approximately equal to m. Okay? So then what I have here is h equals minus 1/2 sum over I and j, j I j, sigma I, sigma j, minus b times n times m, right? And so you see that this, again, that this term clearly breaks the symmetry of, you know, m going to minus m, right? This term actually cares about the sign of m. Yeah?
When you talk about the average randomization, mm-hmm. what are you averaging over? Because if you're averaging over just over all the sites, this should be exactly.
Right. So I'm averaging over, so in principle, I'm talking about thermodynamic average, meaning I'm averaging over all possible configurations of spins with a particular weight, right? And the weight is the usual statistical mechanical weight, right? Minus h divided by the temperature. So that's what I mean, right? But it so happens that, you know, averaging this kind of thermodynamic averaging and averaging over a large system are actually the same thing. Okay, so let me assume for concreteness that B, this field is positive, right? So then clearly this positive B prefers a state with positive M, right? And so let me do the following. Let me calculate the relative probability of a state with positive M, or of a state with negative M, right, over a state with positive M. Okay, so let's calculate a relative the following relative probability of a state with negative M, which is not preferred by this field, but it still has a finite probability due to thermal fluctuations, divided by probability of this state that's preferred by B. So clearly that the ratio of those probabilities is going to be proportional to E to this part of the Hamiltonian, because this is the only part of the Hamiltonian that cares about the sine of m, right, divided by t, right? So this ratio is going to be equal to E to, so minus n b m divided by t. And so so one note about notation, I will always assume that the temperature is measured in energy units, right? So I'm not going to be using KB explicitly anywhere. Okay? So is this exponential divided by the same but with a plus sign? So N B M divided by T. So this is equal to E to minus 2 N B M divided by t, right? So for a finite lattice, if n is finite, right, this ratio is something that's finite, right? So both states are in principle probable. They have finite probability. So now let's do the following. Let me take the limit of this ratio as B, as the magnetic field that prefers one state over the other, as B is going to zero, while first keeping this n finite. Okay, so let's keep n finite.
This is the probability of m less than zero when basically has perfect downspin, and m greater than zero is the perfect.
No. It's whatever m is, right?
Okay.
M does not have to be equal to one.
Okay. Could you please explain again how you got that?
This.
Yeah.
So I mean, this is just a ratio of of those Gibbs factors, right? That tell you the probability of a particular configuration of spins. And it only involves this part of the Hamiltonian because this is the only term that is actually different in the two cases. Okay, so let's keep n finite, meaning let's keep our system size finite, right? But take the limit of B going to zero. Then you can see clearly that in this case, this ratio is going to one, right? So this ratio in the limit B going to zero is going to one, right? So what does this mean? It means that if my system is finite and I turn off the field that prefers state with positive m over state with negative m, those states will become equally probable, right? Which means that if you observe the system over a long enough time, you will see both states happening, and therefore the average value of magnetization you will actually measure is going to be zero. Okay? So in this case, m is going to be zero if observed over a long enough time, because both states will be equally probable. Okay. On the other hand, let me now take those limits. Let me now do the following. Let me first take the limit of n going to infinity, and only after that take the limit B going to zero. Yeah.
So you say you observe both states, but surely that requires it to go from one state to another, which
right.
I said before is very unlikely, even if they
well, yeah. So, but in a finite system, again, if you observe the system over a long enough time,
eventually
that's going to happen. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be too long to be worried about?
Well, it's long, but it's, you know, if the system is finite, it's finite. So strictly speaking, m is going to be zero. So on the other hand, let me first take the limit of n going to infinity, and only after that take the limit b going to zero, right? So let's first take the limit n going to infinity, and then take the limit of B going to zero, right? Then clearly, again, that ratio in this case is actually going to zero, right?
You're taking those limits assuming that you're far away from the critical temperature, right?
No, that doesn't matter. I mean, for any temperature that's below critical temperature, it's going to be fine. I mean, as long as I really take n to infinity, that's not going to matter. I mean, for any T below critical temperature, M is going to be something that's finite. It can be very small, but it's still finite, right?
It seems like you're actually talking about two different quantities, M here, where like, in the probability of M.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is, see, the point I'm trying to make here is that defining this kind of quantity M, right, only makes sense in an infinite system. If I try to define it in a finite system, you know, it will actually fluctuate between the two values, and it's going to be zero, right? So talking about M, that's not zero. That's the point of this argument, that talking about M that's not zero is only makes sense in an infinite system.
Okay.
Okay. So in this case, the so if I first take the limit N going to infinity, which is called thermodynamic limit, and then take the limit B going to zero, this ratio is actually going to zero. Okay? And so in that case, the system will indeed remain. So if I first apply this field that picked a particular direction of M, right, particular sign of M, and then switch off the field, the system will remain in that state with positive M indefinitely, even though you know, in principle, the other state is just as good. Okay, so basically, again, so what this argument shows is that you know, phases and transitions between them are only sharply defined in the limit when the system size is infinite. Okay, so of course, real systems are not infinite; they are finite. But you know, for a macroscopic system, the time scale for actually observing that fluctuation to the other state is going to be extremely large. Okay, so even though in principle it's possible, in reality it's not going to be observed. Yeah.
Could we have also seen this result by calculating the critical temperature as a function of N and then looking at
that? Well, see, what this shows is that for finite N, there is no such thing as a critical temperature. M, the order parameter is always zero. So the transition only, strictly speaking, only happens when N is infinite. Okay, so now the question is, how do we describe theoretically that so this situation when we have a finite M, which vanishes at the critical temperature. How do you describe the appearance of this ferromagnetic phase and transition out of it in this model? Okay. So the simplest description that's not entirely correct, but nevertheless, oh no, this is too complicated for me. Just erase. So the simplest description, which is not entirely correct, and well, it's actually incorrect in many ways, but which is nonetheless useful in the sense that it can actually describe this event of a phase transition, right? So it's called mean field theory, and we're going to start from mean field theory, and then talk about what exactly is wrong with it, and how we can improve it. Okay. So mean field theory is based on the following trick. So let me write sigma I on every side in the following way, as sigma I minus its average value, which is m, right, plus average value, right? So sigma I minus m plus m. So if I plug this into the Hamiltonian, so I have a product of sigma I and sigma j in the Hamiltonian. So this can be written in the following way then, as product of deviation of sigma I from M times deviation of sigma J from M plus M times sigma I plus sigma J and then minus M squared. So far this is all exact. And now what I will assume is that those deviations of sigma i's from m are small. And since this is a term that's quadratic in those deviations, I'm going to just neglect it. Okay? There is no, absolutely no justification for it. Let's just assume that this is true. Okay. So then, my Ising model Hamiltonian takes the following form. So it's minus 1/2 sum over I and j, j, I, j. I have m sigma I plus sigma j, and then plus 1/2 sum over I and j, capital J I j times m squared. Okay. Now let me introduce the following quantity. Let me call capital J without any indices the sum over j of j, I, j, okay? So the sum does not depend on the index I, because all the sides, I'm assuming that the lattice is uniform, and so all the sides of the lattice are equivalent, okay? So therefore, if I take any side and sum over all the other sides of the lattice of those interaction parameters, it's going to be the same, okay? Now, of course, what I also want to assume is that this sum is finite, right? Which means that those interactions are sufficiently short range. Okay, if all the spins of the lattice are interacted with all the other spins equivalently, then this would not converge for an infinite lattice. Okay, so what I want to assume is that J is finite. And therefore, jij's are sufficiently short range. Okay, and this is certainly not a problem, in any real situation. The interactions will indeed be short range. So if those are the spins, for example, this is an exchange interaction which falls off very fast with distance, okay? And in any case, what we are interested in is, how when we have only short-range interactions between those degrees of freedom, those short-range interactions lead to this long-range organization of the spins into a particular phase, okay? Okay, so then, in terms of J, I can rewrite this Hamiltonian in the following way. So H is going to be, so here the sums over I and J will give me the same thing, right? Just J times sigma I, and so this gets rid of the factor of 1/2 there. So I have minus M times J times sum over I sigma I. And then here I'm going to have plus 1/2 N times J times M squared, okay? So I will keep, again, the number of sites here, N, finite, okay? And we can take that to infinity later.
Should the J that you defined there have like an index I and should be inside of the sum?
Sorry?
The big J that you define as the sum over J,
right?
Shouldn't it be under the sum as well?
No, no, so that's the point that, you know, that sum here, sum over J, since all the sites of the lattice are equivalent, it's actually not going to depend on I, right? And therefore, this is just a constant. Okay? So let me move this. Oops. No.
I think there is a third bar as well.
Sorry? Oh, there is. Okay, okay, okay. I see, okay. Okay, so now, what was the point of this, of these manipulations? The point is that now, so instead of a Hamiltonian describing interacting degrees of freedom, right? Now we actually have a Hamiltonian of what looks like a Hamiltonian of non-interacting degrees of freedom, right? In some effective field, okay? And for such a Hamiltonian, we can actually calculate anything we want exactly, okay? So let's calculate its free energy. So the Helmholtz free energy for this system, which is minus T times log of the partition function Z, right? So I'm assuming that this is something that you've seen before, okay? And then the partition function Z, I can calculate as a sum over all the possible values of sigma I on all the sites, so that's how I will denote it, of E to minus the Hamiltonian divided by T, right? So the second term here is just a constant. There's nothing to sum here. So this just gives me E to minus N J M squared divided by 2T, sorry, okay? And then this term, this is just sum of terms corresponding to all the different sites, right? Therefore, I can calculate the sum over different values of sigma I for each site of the lattice independently, right? This is what I could not do when the spins were interacting, right? So here I can just take a product over all sites from 1 to n, right? And then within that product, I'm going to sum. So for each I, I will sum over the two possible values of sigma I, which is plus or minus 1, right? And then I have E to M J sigma I divided by T, right? So that sum simply gives me twice hyperbolic cosine of mj divided by t, right? And that hyperbolic cosine is just taken to power n, right? So what I have then is e to minus n j m squared divided by 2t again. And then I have twice hyperbolic cosine of m j divided by t taken to the power n. And so if I now take the log of z, my free energy is going to be equal to so n j m squared divided by 2, right? And then minus n t times log of 2 hyperbolic cosine of m j divided by t, right? So here, this free energy is proportional to n, right, as it should. And so if I just define free energy per site and divide by n, the dependence on n will actually disappear. Okay? Then I can say that I've taken the limit of n going to infinity. Okay. Okay, so now this free energy depends on magnetization m as a parameter, right? And so to find the actual value of m for a given temperature, what I have to do is minimize the free energy with respect to m, right? So the actual equilibrium, thermodynamic equilibrium state of the system is obtained by minimizing that free energy. Okay? So we calculate df dm. And so df dm is equal to n times j times m. And so the derivative of log of hyperbolic cosine is simply a hyperbolic tangent, okay? Because it's 1 over cosine, and then the derivative of cosine is hyperbolic sine, right? So this is just equal to minus n j times hyperbolic tangent of m j divided by t. And I want to set this equal to 0, right? So I'm minimizing the free energy as a function of m. So this gives me an equation for m. Okay. So the equation I get is m equals hyperbolic tangent of m j divided by t. Okay. So the solution of that of this equation determines m as a function of t. Okay. In principle, I cannot solve this equation at all temperatures analytically. It can easily be solved numerically, but the easiest way to see kind of roughly what the solution looks like is to solve it graphically. Okay, so let's solve this graphically. So let me plot the left-hand side and the right-hand side of this equation as a function of m. Right? Do it like this. So the left-hand side is just a straight line, right? Going through the origin like this. And then the right-hand side, so it's 0 when m is equal to 0, right? And then it's going to 1 when m is going to either plus, is going to 1 when m is going to plus infinity, and it's going to minus 1 when m is going to minus infinity. Okay? So it looks roughly like this. Here's plus 1 and minus 1. And so I have this branch here. And here, okay? And the solutions of this equation are given by the points where the two curves intersect, right? Now, so they clearly always intersect at the origin when m is equal to 0, right? And so this is the solution of this equation corresponding to the paramagnetic phase when the magnetization is equal to 0. So this is one solution. And then in principle, we can also have solutions, and there are always two of them, equal in magnitude but opposite in sign, where m is not equal to 0. And let me call this value plus m0, let's say, and minus m0. So those two solutions would be the solutions corresponding to the ferromagnetic phase when m is finite. So now the question is, when do we have those solutions corresponding to non-zero m, and when we do not have them? So this clearly depends on the slope of that function, hyperbolic tangent of mj over t, at the origin, right? So if the slope is like this, like I've drawn here, right, meaning that the slope of tangent is greater than the slope of the straight line, which is 1, right? Then, as you can see, there are those two non-trivial solutions. However, if the slope was smaller, so if the function looked like that, then there would not be a non-trivial solution, right? Then only one solution at m equals 0 would remain. So the slope of that function, I can obtain it just by expanding the hyperbolic tangent for small values of argument. And so tangent of x for small x is just equal to x, approximately. Okay. So then we see that so everything depends on whether this ratio of j over t is greater than 1 or less than 1, right? So when j over t is greater than 1, meaning t is less than j, we have non-trivial solutions of this equation. We have solutions of this equation with non-zero magnetization. Right? On the other hand, when t is greater than j, the only solution is m is equal to 0. While here we have the two solutions with non-zero m. Okay? So clearly this means that j here is the critical temperature. Okay? So for temperatures less than j, there is a ferromagnetic solution, while for temperatures greater than these, there is no ferromagnetic solution. Yeah.
So if we go back to the mean field Hamiltonian, uh-huh. We had like a m times sum over I of sigma I.
Right.
And when we were at the beginning of the lecture, when we were going over the probabilities, we could replace that by m.
Right.
approximate that by m. And so if we do that in this case, then we'll also not get any phase transitions because the only solution will be when m equals 0.
That replacement of the sum by m was an approximation.
Right.
It's something that's of the order of m. And the point of that was just to give that argument that to actually have non-zero m, you know, we have to have an infinite system. So here we've actually calculated what the expectation value of sigma I is exactly by not exactly, you know, given the assumptions of mean field theory, we can actually calculate what the expectation value of sigma I is. And that's simply given by, you know, minimizing this free energy. Okay? Maybe I've misunderstood the question, but.
I got that part. The question was like, what if we, I guess the question is, how do we know that if we didn't make that approximation in the probabilities, then we would find that there is a phase transition with a finite system size? I guess my point is that this approximation gives us no phase transitions with this analysis, which we know is wrong.
Right.
So how do we know that it didn't give us the wrong conclusion with the probabilistic calculation?
Well, there was nothing really wrong about that assumption. I mean, indeed, the sum over I of sigma i's, you know, for a large system is equal to m on average. Okay?
I guess.
Conclusion we can make here is that TC in mean field theory is just equal to J, right? And that makes sense because the J is the energy scale, right, that tells us about how strongly the spins interact, right? So then it makes sense that if the temperature, which tells you about the strength of thermal fluctuations, if the temperature is much less than that energy scale of the interactions between the spins, right? The thermal fluctuations should not be able to kill the alignment of the spins. While if temperature is larger than that energy scale, then the thermal fluctuations will be able to overcome the tendency of the spins to align. Okay. And so if we actually solve this equation numerically, which is very easy to do, we would find exactly this kind of behavior. That m is, let's say, if I pick a solution with positive m, right, it's going to be equal to 1 when t is equal to 0. And then drop continuously to 0 at TC, which is equal to J. Okay. So these kind of transitions, by the way, where the order parameter vanishes at the critical temperature continuously, are called continuous or second order phase transitions. So it's also possible that the order parameter may vanish discontinuously, meaning that it's finite below critical temperature and then jumps from a finite value directly to 0 at TC, okay? So such transitions are called first order transitions. And well, so, you know, both transitions occur in nature, but for reasons that will become clear a little bit later, the continuous phase transitions are much more interesting. Okay, and so we will focus basically exclusively on this type of phase transitions. Okay. Now, so for such continuous transitions, there is a following observation we can make. So since M vanishes continuously at TC, right, near TC, M is small, right? Which would not be the case, for example, here, where right near TC, if you just go a little bit to the left of TC, M can be large. Okay, here, if you get close enough to TC, M can always be assumed to be small, right? And therefore, what we can do to simplify the problem, at least for T near TC, is expand this free energy in Taylor series with respect to M. Yeah.
One question with respect to that. One of the assumptions that we make to get into here, to have this J, is that the interactions are of short range. Right.
Right.
Near the critical temperature, the correlation length goes to infinity.
Right. So that's, but that's, no, that, that's a different thing, right? So we will talk about that later. So correlation lengths indeed goes to infinity, but the underlying interactions are still short range, right? And that's the interesting thing, right? How long range correlations can develop out of an underlying interaction which is very short range. Okay, and that's precisely the, you know, one of the interesting things, right? Okay, so for a continuous phase transition, if T is sufficiently close to TC, we can expand this free energy in Taylor series with respect to M. Okay. Okay. Let me erase this section. And let me also do what I mentioned before. Let me define, instead of this total free energy, let me define free energy per site. So I will divide this F by N so that the dependence on N just disappears. And let me call this small f. It's going to be free energy per site, right? This is J M squared over 2 minus T log twice hyperbolic cosine of M J divided by T. And let me expand this function in Taylor series with respect to M. Okay. So I'll skip all the algebraic details, which are simple. So if I expand F to up to fourth order in M, right, and you will see why I need to expand to at least fourth order in just a second, then I get the following. So this term stays as it was, Jm squared over 2. Then the second order term coming from here is equal to minus 1/2 T M J divided by T squared, right? And the fourth term looks like this, 1 over 12 T M J divided by T to the fourth, right? So the expansion of this function is even, right? So the expansion of this function has only even powers of M, which expresses the symmetry of the original Hamiltonian with respect to the change of sign of M, right? So that free energy also doesn't care about the sign of M. Both signs are equivalent, right? And so if I use here the fact that J is equal to TC, I can rewrite this in terms of TC, right? So I can write this in the following way: TC over 2. So if I combine this term and this term, 1 minus TC divided by T times M squared, and then plus TC to the 4th divided by 12 T cubed M to the 4th, right? And now, so let me plot this function, small f as a function of m, for t less than tc and t greater than tc. Okay. So let me so this is going to be f of m. This is m, right? So for t less than tc, right? If t is less than tc, if t is less than tc, something wrong here. Sorry. I want to do it for t greater than tc. Sorry, I just confused myself. When t is greater than tc, right, so this is less than 1. And therefore, the coefficient of the m squared term here is positive, right? While the coefficient of the m to the 4th term is always positive, right? So therefore, this function is simply a parabola, basically. It's just a parabola with one minimum at m equals 0. And so indeed, then, if you minimize f of m as a function of m for t greater than tc, the only solution we will get is m equals 0. Right? However, so when t becomes less than tc, what happens is that the sign of this coefficient of the of m squared term changes. Right? And so then the function actually changes shape. Right? So what happens exactly at tc is that the second derivative of f with respect to m becomes equal to 0, right? So that minimum here becomes flatter and flatter. And eventually, when t becomes less than tc, what happens is that we get two secondary minima for m not equal to 0. While this minimum at m equals 0 actually becomes a maximum. So this is t greater than tc. For t less than tc, the function. Sorry?
In the t less than tc case, the 0, m equals 0 is a local
maximum. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in fact, you know, this is why. Let me just draw it first, and then we'll talk about this. Yeah, so it's not the global maximum of this function, right? So in fact, you know, the reason we want to keep terms of up to fourth order in M is precisely that issue. So when T is greater than TC, right? Here I could actually neglect the fourth order term, right? Because it's a parabola anyway. And the point is, you know, when m is going to either plus or minus infinity, we want the free energy to increase, right? Because the states with very large m are clearly not physical, and they should be prohibited by large free energy, right? However, when t becomes less than tc, right, the coefficient of that m squared term becomes negative. And so if you only kept the quadratic term, right, what you would get is a parabola which bends downwards, right? Then the minimum of f would actually correspond to m equal to either plus or minus infinity, which is clearly not physical. So what's saves the situation here is the fourth order term, which overcomes the quadratic term when m is large, okay, and produces minimized finite value of m. Okay. And so here we see that for t less than tc again, so we have actual minima at plus or minus m0, right? Some finite values of m, while the solution with the paramagnetic solution with m is equal to 0 actually becomes becomes a maximum of free energy, okay? Okay, so then, you know, the reason this is useful, this kind of expansion is useful, is because we can actually find now the temperature dependence of m analytically, right? If you just minimize this free energy. So let me move this down. Okay, so let's minimize f with respect to m now. So I have df dm, which is equal to so tc 1 minus tc divided by t times m, right? And then plus tc to the fourth divided by 3t cubed m cubed equal to 0, right? So if you are looking for a non-trivial solution, I can just cancel one power of m. And the solution looks like this. So m can have any sign, plus or minus t divided by tc square root of 3, 1 minus t divided by tc, okay? So in particular, if I forget about all these numerical prefactors, which are really not important, what I can say is that m near tc behaves in the following way, as tc minus t divided by tc to power beta, where beta here is equal to 1/2. So beta is equal to 1/2. Or I can also, let me also define, let me call this dimensionless quantity here, a reduced temperature. So I'll call this small t, t minus tc divided by tc. So this simply measures distance of the temperature to the critical temperature, right? And I divide by tc to make this dimensionless. So then I can say that m behaves near critical temperature, so for small reduced temperature, small t, right, as minus t 2 power beta, which is, again, equal to 1/2. Okay? So beta is something that's called a critical exponent. So in particular, this one is magnetization critical exponent. Or more generally, an order parameter critical exponent. And so this is, in fact, a very general and important feature of all continuous phase transitions, that quantities of interest to us, like the order parameter, like, you know, later we'll calculate correlation functions, specific heat and other things, all these quantities near a continuous phase transition behave as such universal power laws of the reduced temperature, okay? Universal means that this beta here is a simple number, 1/2. It does not depend on any of the details of the original microscopic Hamiltonian. Okay? And so it's these universal power laws that we are basically after. Okay? So the set of such critical exponents completely characterize the particular type of a continuous phase transition. Okay? And what we want to do is basically calculate those critical exponents. Okay? Okay, so let me just, so what I want to do next is introduce a few more critical exponents. So maybe let's do this next time. Okay? Yeah.
Is it supposed to be obvious that this beta completely this like is the only parameter I need? I mean, we only got this because we Taylor expanded around some TC.
Right.
It could have been doing all sorts of funny stuff before we got to that. So how is it that knowing beta tells me everything about that particular type of space transition?
No, it's just knowing beta tells you how things that you are interested in that you can measure, let's say, like this magnetization, how it behaves as a function of temperature, right? The reason it's interesting is because it's precisely because it's universal, right? So there will be a lot of very, very different, microscopically very different systems that may exhibit critical exponents which are the same. So that tells you that, you know, those systems are actually, they have something that unifies them, right? And that's interesting. So if critical exponents were different for any different microscopic system, right? You take one sample, you measure one critical exponent. You take another sample of, let's say, the same substance, but you measure a different critical exponent. That means that this critical exponent doesn't actually teach you anything, right? If it changes, depending on, you know, parameters which may not be controllable, right, then it means that you're not learning anything. But when this is something that allows you to actually unify different systems and where, you know, those exponents are independent of uncontrollable details, then, you know, you are actually learning something. So that's why it's interesting.
Questions. The first one, you said before that we're going to think as we're in a general dimensionality, right?
Right.
Here, where does the dimension come into play?
Here, no. So here, so this is in fact one of the shortcomings of mean field theory, is that in mean field theory, dimensionality doesn't play any role. You get the same results independent of dimensionality. In fact, in reality, critical exponents do depend on dimensionality, and critical behavior and properties of phase transitions depend very strongly on dimensionality, and that's why mean field theory is not, we'll have to improve on it.
Yeah. The other thing, the form of your lattice is encoded on the G, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So,
in the
in the J's. Right?
Yeah, so,
in this here, you, I mean, you make it general for a cubic lattice, right? Where you, I mean, your argument is that there is no, nothing special over a site.
Right.
But in reality, is that a good approximation?
So again, mean field theory, as we'll see, actually doesn't care about anything. The shape of the lattice, the type of order parameter, in mean field theory, whatever you apply this type of theory for, in fact, this critical, for example, the order parameter critical exponent will always be 1/2. Whether it's for a magnet or for a superconductor. So, and that's why this is really inadequate, because in reality, critical exponents differ. But as far as the geometry of the lattice is concerned, so if we have this type of model where, I have some degrees of freedom or spins on different sides interacting, and if all you want to do is align them in the same direction, then, the geometry of the lattice doesn't matter, because all you want to do is align them. If I wanted to anti-align them, which would be the case in an anti-ferromagnet, then geometry of the lattice can actually play a very significant role, because on some lattices, it's not easy to anti-align.
And we're always working in a regime where the length scales are either larger than the microscopic detail and smaller than the size of the object itself, right?
No, so in this case, this model, the Ising model, you can think of that as a microscopic model. So the sides can be just atoms in the crystal lattice, while sigmas represent, let's say, magnetic moment on that side.
What I'm saying is when we're the length scales at which these theories are valid is either your length scale is you're zooming into an extent that you don't get to down to the level of a single atom, and you don't zoom out to the extent that you go outside of the object. Within some sort of.
Not sure exactly what you mean, but I mean that. So that model, the model we started from, is a microscopic model. Let's say we can think of that as a microscopic model. We'll see later that. In fact, a way towards calculating those critical exponents better than in mean field theory would be precisely of making that transformation of increasing the length scale over which we view the system. So that kind of transformation is called renormalization group, and that will allow us to calculate the critical exponents more precisely, but we can start. We can think of starting just from a microscopic model.
The last thing, here we consider spins as classical variables, right? So what happens if I take the Hamiltonian to be an operator, right?
Right.
Really quantum mechanically.
Right. Yeah. Right. We may get to that if there is time, but so in some cases, not always. In certain cases, a d-dimensional quantum mechanical system behaves as a d plus one dimensional classical system. We might get to that. For now, we will be talking about classical systems. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So then, we'll meet tomorrow.